Now, what's this here? From the edge, Australia's lost histories. Well, that's good. I think Australia should lose most of its histories. We don't want to disturb the past and bring up issues that might embarrass us. But why do you want to dredge up all these things?
What I'm trying to do in this book is to really haul back into view a lot of the places, a lot of the regions in Australia for which I believe we don't actually see their histories. Yeah.
Well, you go this far. The country that we long perceived as a land without history is one of the most deeply storied countries on earth, and every inch of this continent is deeply embedded with indigenous history.
Mm. All of these four, there's four histories of place here, and the book's called From the Edge because all of these histories are on the edge of the continent, literally, and they're also on the edge of our consciousness historically. These are histories we don't see. I mean, if we think of the Pilbara, for example, we think of mining, we think of the economy, we think usually of post-1960s Australia and the boom. So what I'm trying to do is to burrow down into the particular, to the local, to the regional, and place our histories on our own soil in what I think is the central drama of Australian history.
Okay, I'll make a confession.
Which is Indigenous.
I think this is a pretty good book. Take us back to 1797 and 15 blokes, 5 Brits, 12 Bengali seamen, and how they became the first overlanders in Australia and walked through 700 miles of Aboriginal country.
Well, this is a story I've known about, I guess, since I wrote a book called Looking for Blackfellas Point, which is the history of southeastern New South Wales, some years ago now. This is a story that we've had a journal, a 6,000-word journal of a record of this walk of 700 kilometres in 1797 of 17 people along the southeastern coast of Australia. Yet so far, I mean, that's one of the mysteries of it, is that the central, you know, what I see as the central aspect of the story, the contact between these walkers, 12 of whom were Indian, yeah, they were Lascars, as they were known at the time, Bengali seamen, and 5 British sailors walked that 700 kilometres. But the untold part of that story for over 200 years has been the contact that those men had with Indigenous people.
Okay, before we get on to this, why were they here? Why did they come to Australia from Calcutta?
Sure. So it's basically a speculative trading venture. The ship leaves Calcutta in late 1796. At that time, no one knew that Bass Strait existed. Certainly the people in Sydney weren't aware of Bass Strait's existence. So this ship leaves Calcutta, crosses the Indian Ocean, travels south under the Great Australian Bight, and then underneath the bottom of Tasmania, and then intends to head up north to Sydney. It's wrecked near Flinders Island on a small island called Preservation Island. It's loaded with rum and Chinese porcelain. It's an attempt to set up trade with this particular trading firm, Campbell and Clark from Calcutta, Scottish traders essentially, and it's wrecked on Preservation Island. Everyone survives initially, and the captain of the ship, Gavin Hamilton, decides that he will put his 17 best crew into a longboat to reach Sydney to get help, yeah? And he writes a letter and hands that letter to the two leaders of that longboat expedition, William Clark and Hugh Thompson. And they get in the longboat in February 1797.
How long is a longboat?
It's about the size of a surf boat. I mean, it's right. Very small, but it was their only option. I mean, waiting in 1797 on Preservation Island for a passing ship wasn't a good option. So they set out to reach Sydney in that longboat. Now, that longboat is also wrecked as they head north on what is now 90 Mile Beach in Victoria. Washed ashore, again, they have no alternative, they believed at the time, but to walk to Sydney. So they set out with very little provisions, no knowledge, of course, of the country, only knowing north was their only lodestar, essentially. And they hugged the coast because they were fearful if they went inland that they'd get lost. And It's, to my mind, it's one of Australia's most epic, most...
It's an epic in world terms, isn't it?
In world terms, I mean, on the level of human survival. But as I was saying earlier, alone on survival, but as I was saying earlier, if you think about some of the things that dawned on these men as they travelled north, first and foremost, as they moved through different Aboriginal countries and territories, it dawns on William Clark, who's the journal keeper, that, you know, the languages, the culture that we just moved through down at Twofold Bay, for example, is different to the next people we're encountering.
So let's just paint a picture of this.
Yep.
They've got one gun, two pistols, two small swords, and each and every river they encounter, they had to stop and build a raft, sometimes taking up to 3 days.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's really, you know, it's the great parable in a sense, because the masters of the world's oceans, who've come all this distance, are brought to their knees when they start to walk north and they have to build a raft. And which timber do you use? They don't know what timber to use. They have to experiment. Aboriginal people observe them building these rafts and find it quite amusing and actually offer them their canoes at various points as they get at least into what is now New South Wales. And they have trouble sitting in the canoes. They fall out of them. It's extremely amusing to the Aboriginal people. These things are recorded. So And of course, they wouldn't have, or the people who survived, out of the 17, to shorten the story a little bit, 3 survived. 3 made it to Sydney.
Well, you don't need to shorten the story. Let's just dwell on it, because I found it quite marvellous. Clark's first description of an encounter with the Indigenous people is far from flattering.
That's right. I think, and that's not surprising. I mean, the initial reaction was disgust, repulsion. Primarily, Clark was offended by the smell. Their bodies were coated in fish oil. Of course, it was the first Indigenous people he'd encountered. And the first people they actually encounter are the Kurnai people, where just south of Lake's entrance, where they're actually standing to attention and being inspected. Their bodies are being pointed at. They're standing perfectly still, and Clark writes that he could see that the Kurnai men weren't sure if their clothes were actually part of their bodies or something else. And so there's these kinds of encounters, which is really an attempt on both sides to establish the humanity of the other. There's enough detail in this journal that is the only way I could tell the story, to apart from reading the journal, of course, which is about 6,000 words, was to try and tell it at walking pace, you know, to try and embed the story in the country, to know the country through which they were moving. And I think a lot of Australian history, a lot of our real founding history on our soil, the only way to really tell that is to embed that history in the physical place itself, in the country. And that's what I've tried to do with this story of the walk.
As Clark moves on
towards
this hypothetical destiny, does his respect for the Indigenous people grow?
Yes. In fact, what happens is that you referred to that initial sort of disgust. What happens is that he starts to refer to them as his friends. So he realises gradually, basically he's led along, after they enter New South Wales, they're led along Aboriginal pathways.
It is extraordinary. No one tried to kill them.
No, they had both friendly and unfriendly encounters. For example, at Wreck Bay, near Jarvis Bay, they were confronted. By that time, there were only 6 of them. They were standing on the beach at Wreck Bay, 6 left, and 100 or more Aboriginal men confronted them. And Clark, at that point, there was an altercation, and Clark was speared through both palms of his hands. And I think, you know, when you just imagine that situation, of course they could have easily killed them if they wanted to, but they chose not to. And it's a kind of, to my mind, it's a kind of ritual spearing, a ritual marking.
It's almost like the stigmata too.
Yes, it is. That's right. It is very much so. And before that, at Moruya, they were forced to leave the 12 Lascars behind, and they stayed behind at Moruya, just south of Bateman's Bay. We don't know what happened to those people. We don't know. They could have been adopted into Aboriginal cultures there. We're just not sure.
One of these days we may find out through DNA, I guess.
That's true. That's possible, yeah. I'm not aware of anyone trying to do it so far.
What's the process of attrition? We start off with this body, yep, which gets smaller.
It gets smaller and smaller.
And why? So, what happens?
Well, basically, at Moruya, those 12 people can't go any further. And essentially, there's one Lascar and four British seamen left continuing. After that encounter at Wreck Bay, right, so it takes them 2 months to walk to Sydney, right? They start in early March and they arrive in Sydney in early May. So that's a long time walking, and they're averaging, some days up to 20 miles a day. So after Wreck Bay, a couple more can't go any further. Just where the Royal National Park is in Sydney, on the southern extremity of it. And then three are left. Clark, his so-called Lascar manservant, and James Bennett, another British sailor. And they make it as far as what is today called Coalcliff. And they discover coal on the beach, where they make a fire from that coal. And the next morning, they go a little bit further. They make it so a few more kilometres north, and they're crawling along a beach in what is now Royal National Park, and they're picked up, they're seen by a fishing boat, and they're brought the last 40 kilometres to Sydney, where, of course, they are the talk of the town, because no one at that time had gone far beyond the confines of Sydney. Sydney's only 9 years old, and these three people who survived have not only got the journal still with William Clark, it's still in his possession, the Journal of the Walk. They've got the letter from Hamilton back on Preservation Island, who's still waiting to be rescued. And they've walked 700 kilometres.
Clark, in fact, records a growing appreciation of the beauty of Australia.
Yeah, I was really struck by that because, of course, it goes against a lot of the common tropes of the descriptions of the Australian landscape as harsh and barren and so on. And that, too, is a kind of gradual realisation. And he's actually reclines on a riverbank at one point and is really taken away by the majestic trees and the beauty of the landscape. And he conveys those messages to the officials in Sydney as well. And they're really struck initially by how what they think is, you know, so such fertile land awaiting them.
Did the story become well known back in England?
No, because what happened, William Clark, who kept the journal, once he recovered, he went back to Calcutta to tell the owner of the ship, Robert Campbell, of Campbell's Wharves and the squatter, what had happened to the ship, the Sydney Cove, yeah? And there, in a Calcutta newspaper, he published his so-called excerpts from my journal. So all we have, what we do have, is the excerpts from the original. But no one has ever found, and I've tried, I spent a long time trying, half hoping, I guess, that this journal was still in existence. I looked for it in Scotland, I chased down everything in India, and, of course, I've chased down everything here. But we've got that 6,000-word excerpt from his journal, which was published in Calcutta.
Let me read a little from it. The country is described as totally different from this, very rich and fertile, abounding in pines and firs, of which there is not one here. In all the intercourse of whites with the uncorrupted natives of this country, they have found the most kind, humane and generous. where the mate and supercargo were wrecked, no civilized Europeans could exceed them in kindness. Mm. Now, that's a very good opening statement, a very hopeful statement.
It is.
For
it
black
is.
And white relations.
It is. It is. It's a very hopeful story, but we have to be, we can't be too, we have to be realistic in a sense and remember that they're passing through country, they're passing through Aboriginal territories, they're not seeking to build, they're not seeking to take land, they need help. They are they are at the mercy, unlike the normal situation, they are at the mercy of Aboriginal people, entirely at their mercy. And so
then sometimes they were given great mercy, they were fed, they were given muscles to eat.
They were fed on several occasions. The party camped with Aboriginal people all the way up. And even after that encounter at Wreck Bay, when Clark was speared through both palms, they were then led to the same people's campsite and they camped with them that evening. And as Clark remarks, I think, in the journal, that they didn't sleep that night very well, but they were then allowed to go on their way the next morning.
Ellie Nell on RN and via your ABC app, and my guest is one of these provocative historians who won't let sleeping perceptions lie. Mark McKenna, the book is called From the Edge, Australia's Lost Histories. Meanwhile, Captain Gavin Hamilton and his 30 blokes are waiting patiently on Preservation Island.
They are, and they don't actually, they're not rescued for 6 months from the moment that ship is wrecked. It takes nearly 6 months before Hamilton gets off that island. And when two ships come down from Sydney to actually rescue the survivors, they can't actually fit all of the salvaged cargo, which is essentially rum and other Chinese porcelain, etc. They can't fit it on those two ships, so they have to ask Bennett, who's already walked 700 kilometres, right? Hamilton says to Bennett, will you stay here with the cargo and several Lascars while I go to Sydney? So Bennett, who walked that 700 kilometres, then had to stay for several more months on the island. Anyway, Hamilton is rescued with some of the Lascars and survivors. They're taken back to Sydney. But on the way back, one of those two ships is lost at sea. So all lives are lost, and most of those lives were Lascars. There were originally about 45 Lascars on that ship. All of those lives were lost. Not initially in the wreck, but actually when they were rescued, and that ship was lost.
Now, amazingly, Matthew Flinders was on the ship to rescue the blokes on Preservation
That's
Island.
Right, yep. And it's actually when Flinders and Hamilton go back to Sydney, and of course they've got seal skins, and so that this story, not only does it result in the discovery of Bass Strait, it also results pretty directly in the creation of, very quickly, of a large-scale sealing and industry.
A frenzy.
Virtually a frenzy.
Killing,
yeah. And I mean, Flinders virtually starts that. There's a wonderful description on when he first arrives on one of the islands nearby. And, of course, as you do in the late 18th century, when you need to inspect things scientifically, you need to understand them, you shoot them, you kill them, and then you taste them. And there's some wonderful descriptions I've got in the book, actually, of Flinders' various descriptions of the different tastes of the wombat and various other things.
Well, before the U was out, a ship had set up base on Cape Barron Island, and
yes,
that resulted in the sale of 9,000 skins to one Chinese merchant.
Exactly,
This is a boom business.
And it was so quick. I mean, and that's, you know, that's the eye, of course. It's a commercial eye that's very, very sharp and astute and immediately jumps in to exploit that resource. I mean, that was the way that they saw the country. But in a way, you know, Bass and Flinders, even in the remarkable voyages that they had, they predominantly saw the country from the deck of a ship.
Mm, mm.
And what these men did was that boots on the ground. They actually walked it, and they walked it with Indigenous people. And that's the most extensive contact with Indigenous people on the east coast of Australia beyond Sydney.
What about the discovery of that coal at Wollongong?
Yeah,
was that significant?
Yes, very significant, because the coal, that was the first, this was pre-Newcastle, before they found coal at Newcastle. So initially, that Hunter was very excited by when they had news of coal at Coalcliffe. And when the story was retold in newspapers in subsequent years, it was often told through the economic focus of these men were the first to discover coal, apart from the fact that usually they were also the first, quote, white men to have walked the south coast of New South Wales.
Let the record show that Gavin Hamilton dies young, 38, buried in Sydney. Campbell settled in Calcutta and became a very rich man.
Well, Campbell comes to us. William Clark, who led the walk and kept the journal, dies in Calcutta 3 years after he has completed the walk. And Gavin Hamilton dies in Sydney. And just after, Robert Campbell, the owner of the Sydney Cove, arrives in Sydney and no doubt hears the story from Hamilton of what's happened to the ship. And I found a wonderful letter in the Mitchell Library, actually, from one of Hamilton's descendants, which really essentially paraphrased, a letter that Gavin Hamilton had wrote back to his family in Scotland before he left for Sydney. It's this wonderful expression of along the lines of, it's almost Shackleton-like, I'm going to a far and distant land, and I don't know how long I will be gone.
Sitting where you're sitting last week, Nick Brody made it perfectly clear to us that Australia wasn't discovered, that it was incremental, a whole succession of contacts over the years, and you talk about it. Similarly, Australia was not founded in one moment, but possessed in an ad hoc, piecemeal fashion, seized gradually over decades. And you describe the manner in which the British Crown took possession of Aboriginal lands as miraculous, a process of exuberant incantation. What's that mean?
Well, I guess I was... When you read the original journals and you read how the British took possession of, for example, the east coast of Australia or southwestern Australia or the north coast of Australia, there's a customary ritual that takes place. You know, the flag is raised, the glasses are filled, cheers are raised for the king.
Gun volleys fired.
Yes. And so, and then it seems, you know, if you just look at it clinically, it seems like this process of magic. It's like, well, now that's ours. We possess this country in law. It seems strange to me now, but it must have seemed even stranger to Indigenous people, and also in retrospect, of course.
Local Aboriginals helped the English establish their homes. They showed them the nearest springs. They found them seafood and honey. I'm talking now about Captain Bremer.
Yes, that's right. Well, I think a lot of, you know, one of the places I'm writing about is Port Essington in this book. So Port Essington is the British government's third attempt to make a successful settlement in the north of Australia. So part of the reason the British did that between 1838 and 1849, when the settlement finally failed, was because they were worried about the question of British sovereignty in Australia, whether the British actually had sovereignty over the north of Australia. That was the first reason. And the second reason was they were worried about the Dutch and the French. And so it was an attempt to found a new Singapore. And for 11 years, between 1838 and 1849, this, essentially a garrison, attempted to eke out an existence with the dream, initially, of being a new Singapore. And it's one of the most...
When you say with the dream of being a new Singapore, was that what they actually said?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's not you imposing a...
No, it's nothing new. That part of it is nothing new. I mean, no, that was part of the... Merchants saw the ships off. When the ships left Sydney to settle Port Essington, which is, by the way, in West Arnhem Land, about 350 k's northeast of present-day Darwin, when they left, merchants saw the ships off, praising the prospects of a new British emporium in the northern seas. So that was certainly their dream, and it wasn't the first time that they'd had that dream either. There were two previous ones. So, I mean, it's a failing a failed colony, if you like. It's a failed, yet another failed dream to develop the North, one of the first. But one of the things that's really that I found most fascinating about it is that is this kind of existential crisis that emerges because the British don't go inland. There's only barely at any time. They struggle with the environment. They struggle with the heat. They're not dressed for it. They don't build for it. They don't know how to. The process of adapting to that climate is very, very slow. And over time, over those 11 years, slowly what you can see starting to happen is this realization that perhaps the only way to survive here in this place is actually to live in the way or similar to the way that Indigenous people live. I mean, everything that they built decayed. They struggled with malaria. They struggled with the white ants. They were haunted by their failure, if you like, to establish their own civilization, which they saw as superior, of course. And so there's the encounter that you have there between Aboriginal people and the British is quite unusual in the sense that there was a peaceful coexistence for those 11 years, by and large. Only one Aboriginal person lost their lives due to violence. So it's predominantly a peaceful encounter.
Even that is astonishing. It's just not the way we think of our early history.
No, and I think we think of our, here in the southeastern corner of the country, we think of our, understandably to some extent, we think of our history from this southern, southeastern perspective. But if you look from, I mean, people who in the Northern Territory, for example, know about Port Essington and the struggle there pre-Darwin. And, of course, other places that I write about in the book, local people do know about these histories. Let's
read a little bit about the North. The shock of the new, crocodiles devouring Bremer's dog and tugging at men's blankets as they slept in their hammocks, white ants finding the legs of his sofa despite him moving it daily, the sheer luxuriance of the natural environment. When one marine ventured inland from the settlement, he was overwhelmed by the abundance of wildlife, wetland pools with over 500 black swans, wide riverbanks covered in palms 15 metres high, scores of flying foxes, multitudes of brightly coloured parakeets, giant crabs lurching in the mangrove swamps, and the wild cacophony of unfamiliar forest sounds were arresting. Yet all of this paled before the curiosity and wonder they felt when contemplating Aboriginal people's skillful exploitation of natural resources. I mean, it's a breathtaking notion, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, one of the things, yes, it is. And it's an example, I hope what you've just read is an example of what I'm trying to say in all of these places, is an example of trying to embed the history in the physical place itself. But one of the things that happens at Port Essington in the journals that the British keep, you know, is initially it's the same thing as William Clark when he first meets the Kurnai in Victoria. Initially, there's this sense of turning away. There's this sense of a condemnation in the journals of Aboriginal people. And over time, the longer that those journal keepers stay in Port Essington, what starts to happen, of course, is that they get drawn closer and closer into observing and recording that same Indigenous culture from which they initially recoil. And
if only others had remembered or taken that into account, Burke and Wills would have had a happy ending, for example.
Yes.
There's so many stories that end in tragedy in Australia that could have ended well.
Yes, no, it's true. I mean, Port Essington, one of the things about Port Essington is that when the British government finally gives up the idea of continuing, and there's a kind of the last people left there are almost celebrating, it's like the end of war. They're instructed to destroy the settlement before they leave, in case the Dutch or the French might take some advantage of it. And as the ship leaves and sails away, for the next few weeks, the men on that ship danced what they called the kangaroo corroboree. And that to me was such a quite incredible image of, I guess, the way in which both cultures were transformed by their encounter with the other. And the image of Europeans on that ship dancing the corroborees that they learnt at Port Essington for weeks later.
That's on that magical note we will end this. Thanks, mate. You've done it again. Mark McKenna, who won the Prime Minister's Literary Award in 2012 for his book on Manning Clark, is back with From the Edge, Australia's Lost Histories, and it's published by Magunya Press. Mark, thanks for coming back.
Thanks so much, Philip, for having me in. Thanks.